Good day. Welcome to another episode of the Audible Local Ledger Reads to the Blind podcast. You can get more information at audiblelocalledger.org. Stay tuned for today's reading.
Hi, I'm Libby, and I'll be reading you today's Cape Cod Times, dated Friday, April 12th, 2024. In today's weather outlook, we have temperatures reaching almost 60, but we'll have rain and a thunderstorm, tapering off later to light showers. Tonight, lows will get down to the mid-40s, and it will be mostly cloudy with a shower in places later. Saturday and Sunday, temperatures will be in the mid-50s. Saturday looks partly cloudy, but partly sunny, and the rain returns on Sunday. By special request from a few of our faithful listeners, we now present the lottery numbers. For the midday drawing in Thursday's numbers game, we have numbers 5, 4, 0, and 1. The evening drawing that day numbers were 0, 7, 9, and 9. The numbers in Thursday's mass cash drawing were 3, 10, 15, 23, and 28. For Wednesday's Powerball drawing, we had numbers 6, 7, 12, 24, 36, and the extra ball of 15. And finally, for the Tuesday drawing in the Mega Millions lottery, we have numbers 34, 43, 51, 52, 69, and the extra ball of 25. On page 1 of today's paper, there is a very large photograph of the Mayflower 2 passing under the Sagamore Bridge. I believe it's the Sagamore Bridge. And the headline, Glimpse of History, Mayflower 2 passes through Cape Cod Canal. The Mayflower 2 passed through the Cape Cod Canal around 7:15 a.m. on Thursday as people lined the shore to watch. The ship, a historic reproduction, is on its way home to Pilgrim Memorial State Park in Plymouth after a winter spent in dry dock in Mystic, Connecticut for routine maintenance. The 102-foot wooden vessel did not use its sails for the journey. Instead, it was towed the entire way by Stasinos Marine out of Weymouth. It was expected to be crewed by the Plymouth Pawtuxet Maritime Preservation and Operations Team, led by Captain Whit Perry. Crew were not expected to be in period costumes for the voyage. East Ham Dad continues baseball journey he and his son started, by Courtney Jacobs of the Cape Cod Times. Scott Yell and his son Jackson bonded over baseball. In 2007, Dad and son flew to California to watch the Red Sox take on the Oakland Athletics at the Oakland Coliseum. We'd gone to a couple of different stadiums, and then we realized one day while driving to a baseball game that we had been to 5 or 6 stadiums, said Scott Yell, who lives in Eastham. So I said, maybe we should try to get to all 30 over our lifetime, and he said, yeah, that's a great idea. The pair embarked on a grand tour of Major League Baseball parks. Their odyssey brought them to 12 stadiums. Then the tour stopped. Jackson Yell, age 21, a junior at Elon University in North Carolina, was killed by a hit-and-run driver while crossing the street in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, on April 30, 2023. Police later charged a 45-year-old local man in connection with Jackson Yell's death. He was in Myrtle Beach with a club baseball team from Elon. Scott Yell continues the ballpark journey alone, but not without support. And his tour provides an outlet to pay it forward. We didn't finish our quest. I wanted to finish what we started. The tour is helping to heal the big hole in my heart from his death. The pain and grief will never go away. It will just lessen some, Scott Yell said. Scott Yell and his family started the Jackson Yell Family Foundation. The vision is to put good young people into the world, hashtag just like Jackson, and the mission is to encourage moral character and positive growth in kind young people. He's been to 20 stadiums as of April 9th, attending 8 games without his son. When you go to 20 different stadiums, you're sure to see a lot. Every stadium experience is different, Scott Yell said. He saw the defending World Series champion Texas Rangers on opening night against the Chicago Cubs. He threw out the honorary first pitch in Miami, home to the Marlins. his visit to Tampa Bay was more of a personal experience. I met one of Jackson's high school teammates from his basketball team because he goes to the University of Tampa, Scott Yell said. The foundation accepts donations, which go to the Nike RBI, or the Nike Reviving Baseball in Inner Cities, a program that supports the development of young men and women through baseball and softball. Being able to see the young men and women we've been able to impact in a short time is priceless, Scott Yell said. The Jackson Yell Family Foundation will donate $18,000 in 18 MLB cities to benefit the RBI program. In Miami for the MLB tour, Scott Yell met some of the Nike RBI program kids and saw their faces when they met some of the Marlins players. You know they were going to school the next day and showing all their friends photos, Scott Yell said. As part of the donation ceremony at each stadium, Scott Yell will wear a special t-shirt with an MLB and Jackson Yell Family Foundation logo. The shirt also includes the number on the back, representing the number that stadium represents on the tour. The MLB has also arranged for him to be on the field at many of the stadiums for batting practice. He also has friends and family meeting him at the stadiums and other people who are doing the MLB stadium tour. Baseball just has a way of bringing people together, Scott Yell said. His last 10 stadiums are Seattle on May 13th, Arizona May 14th, Los Angeles May 15th and 16th, Milwaukee June 2nd, Chicago June 4th and June 6th, St. Louis June 7th, Kansas City June 8th, and Detroit on June 9th. Scott Yell compared his expedition to the movie Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. I will have done a little of all of that by the time the stadium tour is done, he said. To make a donation, visit jacksonyell.com, and you can make a check payable to the foundation. Jackson Yell graduated from Nauset High School in 2020. Some Cape Cod community donations were made to the Nauset Booster Club in Jackson's name. The Jackson Yell Family Foundation matched those donations, which resulted in a new batting cage for the Nauset's baseball team. The foundation also has plans to improve the Elon Club baseball field with scholarships for baseball players at both Nauset and Elon. In the summer of 2022, Jackson Yell had an internship with TrackMan Baseball, a digital scouting company, as he was in a business analytics major with a minor in statistics. He got to go to all of the Cape Cod Baseball League games and work behind home plate and sit with all the scouts. He loved it, Scott Yell said. The one-year anniversary of Jackson's death is approaching, but Scott wants to keep it simple. My wife and I are going to go visit my daughter and let the day just happen. We don't have anything specifically planned. We just wanted to be together, Scott Yell said. He said that his tour gives life meaning. It helps my family move forward with Jackson. But never will we move on from Jackson, Scott Yell said. Temporary Bridge offers new way to cross Herring River in Wellfleet, by Eric Williams of the Cape Cod Times. Dateline Wellfleet. The drive along Chequesset Neck Road, already a scenic delight with huge views of Wellfleet Harbor and Cape Cod Bay, just got a little more interesting. A temporary bridge spanning the Herring River opened at the end of March as part of the Herring River Restoration Project. It's one lane wide, so traffic can only flow in one direction at a time. A traffic light system has been installed to keep motorists safe as they travel to and from popular Wellfleet spots like the Great Island Trail and Duck Harbor Beach. A pedestrian bridge is affixed to the side of the temporary bridge, allowing bicyclists and pedestrians to cross. It also offers great views of the Herring River. Signs on either side of the span say, "Walk bikes across bridge." Yes, a misspelling, but you get the idea. Why is the temporary bridge needed? The opening of the temporary bridge allows work to move ahead on an adjacent permanent bridge that will eventually allow tidal flow to be restored to the Herring River. The permanent bridge will replace a dike constructed in 1909, that restricts the flow of water upstream. According to the Cape Cod National Seashore, increasing tidal flow will bring salt water back to the river and return it to the thriving and ecologically productive estuary it was for thousands of years before the dike was built. When will the permanent bridge be finished? In an email to the Cape Cod Times, Wes Stinson, project manager for Environmental Partners, the company that's overseeing the ongoing bridge construction, wrote that we're aiming for substantial completion of the permanent bridge by late 2025, with full completion by the spring of 2026. Stinson also provided some interesting facts about the temporary bridge. Type: steel truss bridge manufactured by ACRO. Span: 320 feet total, composed of two 100-foot spans and two 60-foot spans. Road width: 13.5 feet. Height: at an approximate elevation of 10 feet. Abutments: two at either shore. Piers: three. Steel pipe piles: eight 24-inch diameter piles per pier, 24 total, driven into the water riverbed. Total amount of concrete in abutments and piers: 216 cubic yards. Total rebar in temporary bridge piers and abutments: 21,000 pounds. Temporary stormwater drain system incorporated into the bridge. One-way alternating traffic, stoplight at either side. And finally, signal sequence: 30 seconds green-red, 30 seconds red-red, 30 seconds red-green, 30 seconds red-red. Free training program for fishing industry offered, by Denise Coffey of the Cape Cod Times. A free 3-day crew training program for people interested in the fishing industry will be held May 9th to 11th by the Cape Cod Commercial Fishermen's Alliance. It will run from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. The training is meant to introduce more people to the industry, according to Doreen Leggett, communications officer for the Alliance. The training program is for those with no experience on the water. With the graying of the fleet, captains need crew, she said on Tuesday. The Fishermen's Alliance has held training programs in the past because of the growing numbers of jobs in the industry, Leggett said. This training is geared to those who have little or no experience in the industry and would like to learn what it takes to work on the back of a boat. Participants will learn about gear types and how they work, the different types of fisheries, job expectations, basic skills, and in-depth maritime safety and survival. Students will learn how to chain up in the water, how to get into rafts, and how to use flares, Leggett said. Fred Matera, executive director of the Commercial Fisheries Center of Rhode Island, will present the course. Space is limited to 12 participants. You can call 508-887-3224 for an application by April 28th or apply online at capecodfisherman.org. NFL star acquitted murder suspect Simpson dies at 76, by Josh Peter of USA Today. O.J. Simpson, the football star and actor whose life took a shocking turn when he was charged with stabbing to death his ex-wife and her friend, died Wednesday of prostate cancer at the age of 76, according to a post on social media attributed to the Simpson family. Our father, Orenthal James Simpson, succumbed to his battle with cancer, the post said. He was surrounded by his children and grandchildren. During this time of transition, his family asks that you please respect their wishes for privacy and grace. Simpson was acquitted of two counts of murder during a televised trial that gripped America and divided the country, largely among racial lines. But the jury in a civil trial found Simpson liable for the double murder, and he later served 9 years in prison for his role in a botched armed robbery. He was granted parole in 2017. It completed a stunning fall from grace for the once-celebrated running back who won the Heisman Trophy in 1968 while starring at the University of Southern California. At times, he looked unstoppable in the NFL, too, as a member of the Buffalo Bills who was inducted into both the College Football Hall of Fame and the Pro Football Hall of Fame. He capitalized on his athletic success in Hollywood, developing a career as a successful actor and TV pitchman. But it all came crashing down after the murder charges that riveted America. There was the televised low-speed car chase in 1994 with Simpson in his white Ford Bronco and police in pursuit as Los Angeles residents cheered from freeway overpasses. There was the so-called Trial of the Century in 1995 when a host of high-powered figures emerged, including Johnny Cochran, one of Simpson's defense attorneys. He turned a bloody glove found at the scene of the crime into one of the most memorable moments of the trial, saying, as Simpson struggled to put his hand in the glove, "If it doesn't a fit, you must acquit." His acquittal set off celebrations from those who pointed to historically unjust treatment of black people by the U.S. justice system, but dismay from those who argued that, regardless of race, the system favored those who could afford high-priced lawyers. The son of Eunice Simpson and Jimmy Lee Simpson, Orenthal James Simpson was born July 9, 1947, in San Francisco and was known as O.J. from birth. New rules take aim at gun show loophole online sales, by Nick Penzenstatler of USA Today. The Biden administration will take steps this week to crack down on unlicensed dealers selling firearms that bleed into the illegal market. Under current rules, licensed dealers must perform background checks and log the make, model, and serial numbers of guns sold. But hobbyists and infrequent traders don't. Justice officials say too many guns are being sold under what are often referred to as gun show and internet loopholes. New regulations, part of the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act signed in 2022 and an executive order last year, will more clearly define which sellers are engaged in the business and thus need to join the 80,000 other federal firearms licensees required by law to perform background checks. The new rules will take effect 30 days after being published in the Federal Register, justice officials told reporters this week. The expected result? At least 20,000 additional gun sellers will be required to perform the instant background checks that will stop them from selling to felons, domestic abusers, and other prohibited buyers. Who is now required to do a background check? While the rules for gun dealers have always applied to those who are engaged in the business, the question has been what that phrase means. The former standard defined a dealer as someone who sold for profit and livelihood. Gun control groups and Democrats have called for the government to define engaged in the business by the number of sales, such as 5 in a year. Instead, the new standard settles on drawing the line at those who sell predominantly to earn a profit, and it provides key indicators. If a gun seller uses merchant services like a credit card machine, or frequently rents space at a gun show, or repetitively acquires and sells firearms, that person is considered a dealer and must now do background checks. Exceptions include bona fide collectors selling some of their inventory, guns given as gifts to family members, and personal sales tied to a hobby, like hunting or sport shooting. The agency said it has reviewed nearly 388,000 comments, mostly in favor of the proposal, since the proposed rule was published in August. It's a false choice that you have to be in favor of the Second Amendment or in favor of taking your guns away, Vice President Kamala Harris told reporters Wednesday. The new rules come just before the April 20th, 1999, anniversary of the school shooting at Colorado's Columbine High School. In that case, the two shooters purchased firearms from private individuals without a background check. Several of the firearms used were sold by an unlicensed seller at a gun show 5 months before the massacre. This doesn't infringe on your Second Amendment rights, ATF Director Steve Dettelbach told reporters this week. Licensed dealers are already playing by the rules. They keep transaction records. They use serial numbers. They work with the ATF to report suspicious activity. Last week, the ATF issued a firearm trafficking report that showed more than 68,000 guns came through unlicensed dealers over a 5-year period. They represented more than half of the illegally trafficked guns nationwide and were tied to 368 shooting cases, Dettelbach said. Some gun industry groups opposed the new regulation. The National Shooting Sports Foundation said the rule was an overreach and submitted a 28-page comment in opposition. ATF has no authority to improve on what Congress enacted or to create new crimes not enacted by Congress, Larry Keene, NSSF's senior vice president, wrote, "An agency may not rewrite statutory terms or fill in what the agency considers to be gaps or loopholes in the statute." House GOP in turmoil after vote fails. Move follows call from Trump to kill FISA. Ken Tran and Riley Begin of USA Today. Dateline, Washington. Just days after returning from a two-week recess, right-wing fury, spurred on by former President Donald Trump, brought the House to a standstill in a significant blow to House Speaker Mike Johnson, a Republican from Louisiana, as he grapples with a threat to his leadership post. 19 House Republicans shot down a procedural step known as a rule vote in the House on a controversial spying law that has renewed GOP infighting. The move effectively froze the House and left the legislation in a state of limbo. In the days leading up to the vote, House Republicans were confident they could take the lead on renewal of the Foreign Surveillance Authority Act, or FISA, and pass it this week. But it quickly became apparent that several conservative hardliners, furious at Johnson and accusing leaders of leaving their voices out, were angling to shut down the bill. It also didn't help that Trump early Wednesday morning told Republicans to kill FISA in an 11th-hour post on Truth Social, emboldening conservative opposition to Johnson's reapproval plan. All this was happening as conservative agitator Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Republican from Georgia, dangles a motion to vacate over Johnson's head. It's an effort that, if passed, would boot him from the speakership. Greene's move, alongside the open rebellion in the House vote, underscores the growing frustration at Johnson from conservatives who say the speaker isn't fighting hard enough for them. One of the conservatives who derailed FISA, Representative Andy Ogles, a Republican from Tennessee, told USA Today that frustration within hard right ranks has reached a point that it's not clear Johnson would survive an effort to oust him, calling the House fickle. Shortly after conservatives tanked the rule vote, Republican leaders called a snap meeting among GOP lawmakers to discuss the path forward. But members leaving the impromptu huddle didn't describe it as productive. Representative Max Miller, a Republican from Ohio, left the meeting early and said there was zero progress made on renewing FISA. The forum quickly devolved into members yelling at each other and blaming other lawmakers for the dysfunction. Miller, visibly frustrated, said, "If anyone says that there's a path forward on FISA right now, they're lying," Miller said. "Johnson literally has to pull a rabbit out of a magic hat for this thing to work at this point." During the meeting's open mic session, some members called to punish the conservative rabble-rousers for tanking the rule vote. Most lawmakers leaving the intense meeting described it as a venting session, which GOP conference meetings have often become in recent months. "I'm getting deja vu of the deja vu," Representative Mario Diaz-Balart, a Republican from Florida, quipped. All the chaos is against the backdrop of Greene's efforts to oust Johnson, which she launched last month after the speaker worked with Democrats to avoid a government shutdown. The Georgia Republican met with Johnson for more than an hour on Wednesday, but leaving the speaker's office, she said Johnson simply offered a lot of excuses. "He has not done the job that we elected him to do, and I told him that. I said, none of this is changing," Greene said. "Only his actions alone, are the only thing that can sway me." If the House is frozen, will the Senate come up with its own plan? FISA reauthorization may have a clearer path to approval in the Senate, where leaders on both sides agree on the need to extend the spying law, and ultra-conservative senators don't have the same power to derail proceedings. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, said on the Senate floor Wednesday that Congress must ensure FISA authorities are renewed during this work period. Congress takes another break after next week, leaving only 7 days to pass the bill before an April 19th deadline. GOP Whip Senator John Thune, a Republican from South Dakota, told USA Today that the Senate will be exploring options to lead on the reauthorization bill, given the holdup in the House. Representative Thomas Massey, a Republican from Kentucky, said House lawmakers during the impromptu GOP meeting on Wednesday raised the boogeyman of getting jammed by the Senate if they don't handle the spying bill first in the lower chamber. And then somebody suggested that we should just let them struggle with it and send it to us, he said. If that happens, there would be a similar debate on the Senate side over what actually goes in the legislation, though the final result likely wouldn't include the reforms some House lawmakers want because of the general consensus in the upper chamber. However, that attitude is not unanimous. Senator Mike Lee, a Republican from Utah, the leader of the GOP Senate Steering Committee, the upper chamber's equivalent to the ultra-conservative House Freedom Caucus, told USA Today he would oppose renewing the legislation without an amendment to require intelligence officials to get a warrant before accessing Americans' data, a provision that has become a major source of contention in the House. Senator J.D. Vance, a Republican from Ohio, said the surveillance law is in need of serious reform. I'm glad it went down in the House today because I think it gives us an opportunity to force some of those reforms, he said. Trump's foray into the debate on Wednesday appeared to be the final nail in the coffin for House GOP leader's FISA plans. Representative Matt Gaetz, a Republican from Florida, a vocal supporter of changing the legislation, told reporters Wednesday morning the former president was right and his comments helped their cause. Johnson this week said he intends to speak with the former president on the issue soon and defended his plan, arguing the currently effort to renew FISA already includes swaths of reforms and gives the law real teeth to address abuses. Cornell student pleads guilty to threatening Jewish classmates, by Kanishka Singh of Reuters. Dateline, Washington. A former Cornell University student has pleaded guilty to posting online threats, including of death and violence, against Jewish students on campus, the Justice Department said on Wednesday. Patrick Dye, age 21, was charged late last year for making online threats against Jewish students at the Ivy League school in Ithaca, New York. Government officials and civil society advocates have warned about rising threats against American Jews, Muslims, and Arabs since the eruption of the Israel-Hamas war on October 7. As part of his guilty plea, Dye admitted that on October 28 and 29, he threatened to bomb, stab, and rape Jews on the Cornell section of an online discussion forum. The Justice Department said Dye's threats caused widespread panic and fear in Cornell's Jewish community. A sentencing hearing is scheduled for August 12th. Dye faces a maximum penalty of 5 years in prison, a fine of up to $250,000, restitution to victims, and a maximum of 3 years of supervised release, according to the Justice Department. A contact for Dye could not immediately be reached. President Joe Biden has condemned rising anti-Semitism and Islamophobia since October 7, when Palestinian Islamist group Hamas attacked Israel, killing 1,200. We've reached the halfway point of our program, and regular listeners are aware that at this stage of our broadcast, we move to the obituaries. There is just one obituary in today's paper, and it is from Michael Damian Turner. Dateline, Eastham. Mike Turner, age 72 of Eastham, passed away peacefully in the home that he built with his own two hands, with his children by his side. Mike will be remembered as one of the best lobstermen in his field. He was an integral part of the salt air and tides of Cape Cod. He had a love for the sea, his family, a pint and a good book, a campfire, and all things Ireland, especially its traditional music and foods, as well as some good old-fashioned crake. Mike worked incredibly hard from the beginning, always paving his own path and staying true to his family and strong work ethic. He will be missed, but his legacy will continue to live on through his children and grandchildren, where the value of working hard and making one's own path, being adaptable and self-sufficient to the ever-changing tides, and having the ability to make the best of things with what is available in that moment, has been forever imprinted. Mike is survived by his 4 children, 9 siblings, 3 grandchildren, along with many other family members and friends. Family and friends will be notified of future arrangements for a celebration of life. Returning to the news, we have an article headlined, Report, Costco Making Millions Off Gold Bars. Retailer has added silver coins to metal offerings, by Anthony Robledo of USA Today. Costco is making gold off its own gold. The retail chain is making $100 to $200 million a month by selling gold bars, according to a Wells Fargo equity research note. Last October, the company began selling 1-ounce bars made of nearly pure 24-karat gold priced at about $2,000. We view the addition of gold and silver as a smart move for Costco, as it only reinforces its value position, the report said. That being said, pricing at that level and shipping costs suggest it's a very low-profit business at best. Equity analysts said the wholesaler priced its gold appropriately by selling about 2% above spot prices to members, before a 2% cashback reward for executive members and an extra 2% in cashback for those with a Citi card. The metal was responsible for about $100 million in sales between its debut and the end of the fiscal quarter ending November 26th. The warehouse retailer has committed to the metal market by also selling silver coins recently. The coins are sold in tubes of 25 and are non-refundable. The 1-ounce Canada Maple Leaf silver coins were priced at about $680 before selling out online earlier this month. Also for sale are coins with a maple leaf on the front and a silhouette of King Charles III on the back, which may be available for less at your local warehouse. Costco members can buy a total of 5 tubes of coins. Also found on the site, a 2024 1-ounce Canada Maple Leaf 24-karat gold coin priced at $2,219.99. Costco's success with the metal comes as spot prices for gold have risen more than 13.7% since the start of 2024. Puma puts focus on speed at Olympics, steps up marketing battle with Adidas and Nike, by Helen Reed of Reuters. Dateline Paris. German sportswear brand Puma is using this year's Olympic Games and its partnership with sprint champions Jamaica to focus on speed as it jostles with Adidas and Nike to carve out space in an increasingly competitive running and lifestyle market. Puma CEO Arnie Freund aims to boost sales of performance products like running shoes and soccer cleats, and has revamped Puma's Forever Faster message in its first brand campaign in a decade on Wednesday in Paris, host of this year's Games. The campaign features top athletes, including pole vault record holder Armand Duplantis and 400-meter hurdles champion Karsten Warholm. Puma is trying to win over more everyday and serious runners, and its sponsorship of Jamaica's Olympic team and some of the world's best sprinters like Sharika Jackson and Elaine Thompson-Herah helps to associate the brand with speed, said Jeff Lowry, an analyst at Redburn in London. You're never going to sell very many running spikes, but in terms of properly iconic teams that credentialize you as a performance brand and associate you with some of the most exciting athletes, Puma have a super strong relationship there, Lowry said. Freund visited Jamaica at the end of March, attending the country's top high school track and field meet for the first time to launch the Jamaican Olympic kit at the event, seen as a testing ground for young athletic talent. We need to be very clear that Puma is about speed, Freund, who has been in the top job just over a year, told Reuters in an interview ahead of the campaign launch. That's something we need to strengthen further in the consumer mindset. Like other sportswear retailers that sponsor Olympians and pour marketing money into the games, the bet is that athletes breaking records in Puma gear will nudge spectators toward its whole range of products, creating a potential halo effect for everything from marathon shoes to sneakers. Puma's latest running spikes for its Olympic sprinters and hurdlers are in a bright orange hue tinged with pink, picked for the distinct contrast it creates against the blue of the athletics track, according to Puma's senior head of innovation, Romain Girard. Brands like Puma, Adidas, and Nike will also be allowed to celebrate their Olympic athletes' medal wins on social media during the Games for the first time, as the International Olympic Committee plans to relax rules governing online marketing in a pilot project with the World Federation of the Sporting Goods Industry. With the new IOC regulations, we'll be able to use that moment in a better way to congratulate them also via social media. I think that's a win-win for both the Olympics as well as us, Freund said. Today's Ask Carolyn column is headlined, Mom Mortifies Teens by Asking Server to Replace a Dirty Glass. Dear Carolyn, on a recent vacation, our family, including two teenagers, was at a restaurant for lunch. We hadn't had any food yet when I noticed dried food on my water glass. After the server brought our ordered drinks, I calmly noted the food on my glass and asked for a clean one. No drama, and the server was a pro. No hesitation. Brought a new glass and comped us a bottle of water. The hiccup? My teenagers were appalled and embarrassed, basically implying I'm a Karen for first failing to just live with the dirty glass, and second, not apologizing profusely before asking for a clean one. I tried to explain that part of being served includes clean everything, but they were unpersuaded. Did I miss something? Is this a generational thing? Literally made no fuss at all and didn't suggest anything be comped, but I'm feeling defensive. How to communicate that it's okay to politely ask for corrections when things are amiss. Signed, Anonymous. Dear Anonymous, it's not just okay, it's necessary for the proper functioning of a business, and it's a kindness to those who make a living there. But before I explain, stop with the Karen. There are real people named Karen whose lives got appreciably worse a few years ago thanks to the casual public contempt. Not cool, okay? Okay. Now, the crud on the glass. Even if you had been okay with it, eventually someone wasn't going to be. That customer might not have been as gracious about it. Some people have a disgust response to crusted tableware, which is as bad for repeat business as it sounds. So it's the good patrons who report problems, without apologies, profuse or otherwise, and without hemming, hawing, or worse, all of which force busy waitstaff to manage your response, which is less efficient than just swapping out the glass. In your polite request for a correction, you gave the restaurant the chance to fix a problem on the spot, make your experience better, and possibly identify a bigger issue before it grew big enough to scare off other customers. The last thing I want to do is arm a battalion of nitpickers, so here's a threshold for letting stuff go. When it's within normal expectations for the type of restaurant. That's super fuzzy, but better fuzzy lines than fuzzy dishes. Anyway, while we're here, please dedicate some parental focus on the many times self-advocacy will be appropriate, even necessary, for your kids. When their travel plans go awry, when they get overcharged, when they don't like the tone of an evening out. Spines protect quality of life. Or if they're ever in a workplace dysfunctional enough to call for a whistleblower. Or when they're in medical appointments, if they become parents themselves someday. Or when, oh my goodness, their friends or partners try to push them around. Spines are safety equipment. This may be a 400-word overreaction, sure. Your kids may just be in a phase where they find you appalling and embarrassing. Enjoy! But this is an I that begs for a dot. There are options besides entitlement and compliant door-mattery. You modeled one. Myers Birbiglia Find Humor Amid Terror by Brian Alexander of USA Today. Absolute terror. That's how comedian Mike Birbiglia describes the feeling of starting from scratch on an entirely new act after his successful 2023 Broadway one-man show, The Old Man and the Pool, which last year became a Netflix special. I've been a touring comedian for 20 years, and I'm just a blank slate, Birbiglia says. It's never not terrifying. So it's a smart idea to document this time on film because I'm vulnerable. When the camera turns on, I'm dreading it. Fellow comedian Seth Meyers turned the camera on his longtime friend, producing the documentary special, Good One, A Show About Jokes, now streaming on Peacock. The Late Night with Seth Meyers host agrees that getting personal on stage is far more intimidating than a nightly TV monologue written with a staff of writers. There's some dread there, too, Meyers said. But it's not nearly the same as walking on stage where 99.5% of the jokes are things we've written and about ourselves. Birbiglia, 45, and Meyers, 50, spoke to USA Today about finding humor without politics, or, more importantly, offending their wives. This interview has been edited and condensed for clarity. A big part of Good One is trying out jokes in front of an audience, knowing that many will fail. How do you get through jokes that bomb? Birbiglia, if you don't acknowledge that a joke has failed, then it's just another piece of information you're relaying to the audience. They don't really know when a joke is failing unless you're leaning on the joke so hard. Meyers, interesting. So you're saying to just play it off like it was a setup? Birbiglia, absolutely. Sometimes a series of setups. When the audience comes to a comedy show, they're expecting 50 to 100 jokes are funny. If you hit that, you're in good shape. If you have only 13 or 15 good jokes, they're going to have pitchforks. How do you keep from offending your wives with your personal comedy? Meyers, if someone who knows my wife, Alexi Ash, is in the audience, I don't do the joke. I try it in front of people who won't get back to her. If I can get into a place where I'm comfortable with her seeing it, she'll appreciate it. Because more often than not, I make myself the dumber of the two of us. That brings her great satisfaction. Birbiglia, my wife, Jenny Stein, is a poet, and my brother is a collaborator, so I vet everything past them. The only other people I talk about on stage are my parents. Fortunately, they don't watch my act. Seth's parents watch my act more than my own parents. Meyers, this is true. They're massive Birbiglia fans. If you need comedy material in 2024, there's plenty in the political world. Why don't you work that more? Birbiglia, it's a weird moment where people are so dug in politically in this country. I don't think you're changing minds with political humor. I tell personal stories in a way that I become closer to audience members. Anything I bring up with politics will make me farther apart from audience members inevitably, just by the statistics alone. Meyers, unlike my show, when I go out on stage and do stand-up, there's very little politics as well. It's so nice to be up there doing stuff about people you love, as opposed to the things that are making you crazy. Mike, you've been on a villainous streak, playing an elder evicting real estate flunky in A Man Called Otto, and Taylor Swift's bizarre son in last year's anti-hero music video. What gives? Birbiglia, in the Swift video, I'm like this dystopian, greedy son. It started with Orange is the New Black, where I was the corporate evil prison guy. People think it's funny when the smiley comedian is dastardly. I'm all about it if it's a great script. Meyers. Also, Mike has been kicking old people out of homes for like 25 years. He can't support himself doing stand-up. That's a side gig. But really, the best villains are comics. That's why we like them. Alan Rickman in Die Hard is one of the funniest bad guys of all time. Mike, what's the state of the once-blank show now? Birbiglia, it's been about a year and a half. I'm literally on a 50-city tour right now. Every city has a new iteration of the show incrementally. I'll try 5 jokes this week and so on. It'll probably end up being a solo show, on or off Broadway, in about a year or two. But I never fully know until I know. Local fisheries are important. Artist debuts seafood exhibition by Frankie Rowley of the Cape Cod Times. Oysters, monkfish, quahogs, and white hake. At some point, you've seen these creatures in their oceanic homes or covered in lemon juice and served on a white porcelain plate. But have you ever wondered how they got there in the first place? As part of the Art Barnstable's Artist Spotlight program, Mashpee-based artist and former federal fishery scientist Mike Palmer is collaborating with the Cape Cod Commercial Fishermen's Alliance to to showcase the wonders of our local fish and shellfish species and the importance of our local fisheries. The exhibition, titled Ocean to Art, Cape Cod Seafood Palette, is on display at Barnstable Town Hall through June 28th, with an artist's reception at 4:30 p.m. on April 12th. Palmer said he and the Fishermen's Alliance worked to select species to highlight that represented the Cape's 15 towns and respective ports, and ones that show how catches change throughout the seasons. When I retired from the federal government, I really wanted to become more engaged in the local community and wanted an opportunity to give back and connect more directly with these nonprofits who are helping preserve the way of life on Cape Cod, he said. That was kind of why I wanted to align the exhibit with the Alliance, because I think their mission of preserving a way of life here on Cape Cod, sustainable harvest of our fisheries, and focusing on the small boat fisheries, is something that I can connect with and in get behind him. The challenge for Palmer, he says, was figuring out how to aesthetically present these species, as many local fish lack the vibrant colors one might find further down the coast and in the Caribbean. I always enjoy when I can take the ugly and make it beautiful, he said. Monkfishes are a great example of that. That's a horribly ugly fish, but if you can make that something that makes the audience want to look at it, inquire, and be inquisitive about it, then I think I've done my job. As for the audience, Palmer hopes they leave the exhibition with a deeper appreciation for the fisheries and their long-standing historical and cultural impacts on the Cape. Local fisheries are important, and I just want people to appreciate what they bring to the table, he said, pun intended. Ocean to Art, Cape Cod Seafood Palette, is on display inside the second floor hearing rooms at Barnstable Town Hall through June 28th. All of the works in the exhibition are available for purchase, with 10% of all show proceeds going to the Cape Cod Commercial Fishermen's Alliance. For more information about the show, visit the website of Wacoit Bay Fish Company. Weekend Jams. Free concerts in Parrish Park happening throughout spring and summer, by Frankie Rowley of the Cape Cod Times. If you happen to be taking a stroll through Parrish Park in Orleans this spring and summer, don't be surprised to hear music wafting through the air and crowds gathering on the grass as pop-up practices in Parrish Park returns for its fourth year. This year's series is sponsored by the Orleans Cultural District in part with the Massachusetts Cultural Council, the Orleans Community Partnership, and the Arts Foundation of Cape Cod. It kicks off with a performance by Tim Sweeney on April 13th. Shows run every Saturday through June 29th, featuring local acts such as Sarah Burrell, Chandler Travis, and Stephen Russell, and are free to attend. Each performance runs from 1 to 2 p.m., providing Orleans with an hour of musical entertainment and an excuse to get out of the house and into the community. It's just the thing to do on a Saturday afternoon, said Frank Paransky, music coordinator and organizer for the series. You just go into a little park and you can stay as long as you want. There's no commitment, there's no money. It's just a nice little community thing and you could hear some really good music. The series initially began in 2020 as a way to give musicians a place to perform and community members a chance to feel part of their community amid the pandemic. Now, Joanne Keeley, a committee member for the Orleans Cultural District and founder of the Pop-Up Practice series, says their goal of providing a space for community and performance is still the same, but the atmosphere has changed as people have readjusted to life after the pandemic. What's different is it was a chance for people to come out that first year in an unobtrusive way if you were concerned about COVID, she said. Now you're there because you have an opportunity to hear music and interact with each other a little more freely. Who's playing at this year's pop-up practices in Orleans? For Paransky, whose bands Blue Central and the Bitter and Broken Men's Chorus will be playing in this year's series on April 20th and June 15th, the concerts provide musicians with a good atmosphere and audience. It's a really nice listening audience, which is often harder when you're playing in bars and competing with people drinking, he said. It's only an hour long, so it's not a very long gig, and musicians can do it because it's at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a Saturday, and most people have their gigs at night. Paransky also noted that due to the series' name, Pop-Up Practices, artists have more leeway with their sets, meaning they can test out new material on a kind audience. I think the intent is to have people try new things out, he said. It's a nice, forgiving audience. If you make a mistake, nobody's going to say anything negative to you. Here's the full list of performances. April 13th, Tim Sweeney. April 20th, Blue Central. April 27th, Chandler Travis. May 4th, The Free Radicals. May 11th, Stephen Russell. May 18th, Bruce McLean. May 25th, Sarah Burrell. June 1st, Rising Tide. June 8th, Front Street. June 15th, Bitter and Broken Men's Chorus. June 20th, Pavia. And June 29th, Michael Holt. The pop-up practices series runs from 1 to 2 p.m. every Saturday, April 13th to June 29th at Parrish Park in Orleans. And for more information, visit the website orleansculturaldistrict.org. Shaboozy and Willie Jones on Beyoncé's Cowboy Carter, Black Country's Appeal, by Marcus K. Dowling and Cache McClay of the Nashville Tennessean. Beyoncé Knowles Carter made a point of featuring Black crossover artists on her latest album, Act Two, Cowboy Carter. She highlighted and propelled a world of Black artists into the limelight by doing so. These artists include Willie Jones and Shaboozy, who have been fusing country and hip-hop since the inception of their careers. Shaboozy, who's featured on two of Beyoncé's Cowboy Carter album tracks, Spaghetti and Sweet Honey Buckin', says he's making music for the modern cowboy, the modern outlaw, the modern person who stands on their own against insurmountable odds, he tells the Tennessean, part of the USA Today network. Shaboozy's skill as a rapper and singer, adept at bridging cultures and genres, has become his calling card over his decade-long career. On Spaghetti, he appears alongside groundbreaking 1970s-era Black female country performer Linda Martell. His voice also appears on the club-ready dance track Sweet Honey Buckin'. The Woodbridge, Virginia native, born Collins Shaboozy in 1995, is the son of Nigerian immigrants. His father is currently a chicken farmer. Being from Virginia, you've got acts like Pharrell, Missy, and Timbaland, who do come from hip-hop. And you also have that country history as well with Patsy Cline, the Carter family, and Emmylou Harris, Shaboozy says. Ask him to dive into why he's excited to be featured on Beyoncé's album, and the answers are as much informed by his long-term appreciation for Knowles Carter's catalog as they are by getting to advocate for his own nature-loving and intellectual interests via the platform of a 32-time Grammy-winning artist. It's amazing in so many different ways. That's what we grew up on. I was born in 1995. Early 2000s is my era of music. My first exposure to music was probably Beyoncé, Kanye, Jay-Z, and all those people, he says. I don't collaborate with too many people, and for this to be my first one is telling that all the hard work we put in, people have been paying attention. Shreveport, Louisiana native Jones arrives at Cowboy Carter fame after fancying himself a soul-crooning rapper and being aware that his hometown was once the location of country's legendary 1950s-era Louisiana Hayride barn dance show. His hip-hop freestyling and baritone voice have led to him having a viral moment every 18 months for the past 12 years on broadcast television and social media platforms dating back to Vine's birth in 2012. In 2020 and 2021, two of his singles, the anthemic ballad American Dream and summer party song Down by the Riverside, achieved renown. When chronologically contextualized alongside Lil Nas X's near 20 times platinum-selling Billboard Hot 100 smash Old Town Road, the work of performers like Jones and Shaboozy, as well as Cowboy Carter collaborators Tanner Adele, Tierra Kennedy, Raina Roberts, and Brittany Spencer, ultimately served as important tentposts in tethering a small but growing mainstream adjacent community of Black country artists and fans. By the time people started telling me about Lil Nas X and Old Town Road in late 2018, I was looking around at the culture and saw that we had so many country-themed artists ready for a huge moment, Jones says. Jones's appearances on now-defunct social media app Vine followed his performance of Josh Turner's Your Man 1 month prior while auditioning for season 2 of the American version of singing competition show The X Factor in 2013. Another TV hopeful, country superstar Kane Brown. Though unsuccessful in winning the program, Brown's eventual series of iPhone-recorded Facebook videos of him singing covers of modern and traditional country songs led to viral success and his current status. 2 years later, he doubled down on his country music interests while touring with acts like Shawn Mendes and performing covers of Florida Georgia Line's Cruise and Darius Rucker's take on Old Crow Medicine Show's Wagon Wheel. By the mid-2010s, Jones recalls country-tinged rap-leaning artists being courted by industry tastemakers like producer Polo De Don. He recalls artists like Mississippi's Fly Rich Double attempting to get noticed by rekindling Music Mafia and Cowboy Troy's early 2000s hip-hop movement with tracks like Big Boom. The mention of Big Boom causes Jones to laugh. We were prepared about 5 years too early, though. Back then, we didn't know that chances, like working with labels, having platforms with marketing arms to support their work appearing on a Cowboy Carter-type album, were even possible. 2020 and 2021 saw artists like Breland and hip-hop to crossover veteran creator Blanco Brown achieve viral and chart-topping success via their respective tracks, My Truck and The Get Up. Shaboozy arrives as a Cowboy Carter contribution already conscious of cultural intersections, urban versus rural, geographic divides, and, most importantly, country music's place amid other genres. Dig back a decade, and he has a well-regarded 2014 track that name-drops NASCAR legend Jeff Gordon, a 2018 debut album entitled Lady Wrangler, and two albums that followed entitled Cowboys Live Forever and Outlaws Never Die. Being from Virginia, I was inspired by the things that were around me, by the cultural landmarks, and the things I would see. I saw all types of people being in the South or the Mid-Atlantic, but also being in the semi-North. NASCAR was a big thing I took and put into my sound and agriculture. All the things that were exposed to me, I put in my music. Ask him about his fellow emerging Cowboy Carter collaborators, and he's excited to see the quartet of Black women on Blackbird. But when considering Willie Jones's appearance on Just for Fun, he pauses dramatically. You know, back in 2012, I was still in high school and figuring out how I could combine all of my musical interests, and Willie was out there on X Factor, he says. Even though we've met in L.A. and still speak regularly, that makes Cowboy Carter feel like a full-circle moment. Shaboozy has a new album, Where I've Been Isn't Where I'm Going, dropping May 31st via Empire Records. But right now, he's celebrating Beyoncé's arrival to the country genre and the impact she's created for those in the Black country scene. It's great to see us get our flowers and come together in celebration of being different and being unique. And that's all I have time for today. This is your reader, Libby, saying thank you for listening.